Today is Monday, January 4th, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Nigerians prepare for a February 21st presidential runoff election.
Their aim, as some of them told VOA, is to deny the ruling party victory in the first round, which they have succeeded in doing so.
Also ahead, Nigeria grapples with COVID-19 variant amid second pandemic wave.
Be a short period. So if we say, please do not visit your relatives in the next 1 month, let them stay in their own households.
Plus, President Trump on tape pleads with Georgia's election chief to overturn President-elect Joe Biden's victory. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is Nigerians are preparing for a February 21st presidential runoff after ruling party candidate Mohamed Bazoum and former president Mahame Usman fell short of the required 50% vote to win outright. VOA Hausa Services' Mahmoud Lalo reports from Niamey that party supporters are looking forward to the next contest.
Actually, there's no any disappointment from the Nigerians because it has been like that in the past elections. The election in Niger always goes into second round before you get a clear winner who is going to lead the country. So nobody is showing any sign of disappointment. And surprisingly, the opposition parties, especially Model Lumana, which is the major opposition party in the country, are happy with the outcome of the result because their aim, as some of them told VOA, is to deny the ruling party victory in the first round, which they have succeeded in doing so. So they believe a runoff will give them the opportunity to form a strong alliance against the ruling party. So the opposition is in fact celebrating the outcome of the result, while the ruling party is in some way trying to take stock of how and why they couldn't clinch the first round.
Some analysts fear there may be voter fatigue in any second round.
That's one downside to an election going into a second round, honestly. You know, the issue of voter fatigue. Not all Nigerians would be too willing to go out to vote again. So this is a huge task on the two candidates in that they have to re-strategize on how to raise the spirit of voters to go out and vote on February 21st. Nigerians, they want the country to move forward. They don't want to be kind of like get stuck on issues of going to the polls every now and then. They don't want to move on with their lives.
From the lessons learned from the first ballot, do you think the electoral authorities will adopt the same tactics or the same style or the same plan, or there's a room for a little bit of adjustment?
I believe this addition and subtraction of approach and tactics compared to the first round of election. What we have started seeing since the provisional release of the results is a lot of politicking on both sides of the divide. The ruling party, PNDS, is trying to form alliance with other parties, and so also is the Renewal Party, which is the RDR. So this is going to be an interesting scenario with lots of political machination coming in the next few days or weeks. But so far, no party has announced any alliance with another party.
Are there areas you think that can be improved upon based on your observation of the first ballot?
I mean, there are areas that need improvement, when it comes to issue of bringing election materials earlier than what we have seen in the first round. These are some of the issues raised by international and local observers, ECOWAS, the AU, the CENSAD. Those are major points that they raise regarding late arrival of election officials and even materials. And other situation whereby you see election materials running out, and as well as they need to get enough illumination in the polling centers so that when vote counting goes into the night, this needs to have a kind of enough power for people to or energy to for people to see what's going on. The last time what we saw was people using their flashlights from their handsets to count ballot papers. That is really something that needs also to be addressed.
The security is still as high as it is, or because of this runoff, security has been somewhat relaxed?
Based on what I've observed, there are still security men stationed in and around Niamey City. This is probably because the election result was provisionally released yesterday. But what I observed this morning is there's a little bit of relaxation of our security measures so far. In the next coming days, we won't be seeing any security officials on the street. maybe until towards the second round of the election. That's when they will be stationed again, just in case anything might happen or come up.
That's VOA Hausa Services' Mahmoud Lalo speaking with me from Niamey. Nigeria is grappling with a more virulent variant of the COVID virus amid a second wave of the pandemic. Health officials say infections spiked after people ignored an advisory against travel. Dr. Anthony Ibe is Assistant Professor of Medicine at Howard University and Georgetown School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. He says the country should expect more deaths and hospitalizations in the coming weeks.
For Nigeria, with our poor health system, overcrowding, and lack of social safety net by government or other local governments and so forth, it frightens anybody who looks at it. For example, if you read a recent report by the Lagos State Health Commissioner, Professor Bayomi, was talking about 5 hotspots in Lagos. And they're having some areas positivity rate as high as 31.3%. That is extremely high. So Nigeria, therefore, is at risk of an overwhelming spread of the disease and affecting and killing so many people.
The health authorities are blaming the citizens for not heeding a travel advisory when it was issued, and that is responsible for this widespread and also the variant.
There could be blames to go around for everybody. The citizens cannot be blamed for the variant. Haven't found out the reason why the variant has occurred. Even in the United Kingdom, you saw there was a variant. In South Africa, they have another one. So variants of this virus will occur, pop up in various parts of the world. That will be a given. In terms of adherence to preventative measures, the citizens may be blamed to some extent, but you also want to look at it against the background of what is happening. If you're poor, your whole life is dependent on trading, there is no government subsidy or some kind of remedial check or something, what are you going to do? Is it the problem? So that's where the government needs to come. You can't ask people to stay home if they don't have food to eat. They will say they'd rather die. So that's where the government must come in and say, we will be able, if we're going to do a lockdown or have people to stay in, we'll be able to make sure everybody gets one bag of rice, one bag of garri, or any of this basic sustenance for the next 2 weeks also. And then everybody, minimum wage of, if you're maybe 2,000, 3,000 naira, I don't know what exact number it will be for each family. Then people can take you seriously. People can now listen to what you're saying. Because one, it'll be for a short period of time, and two, it will help to, you know, cut down on the spread. And more so, we have not perhaps done a good job in the messaging.
Critics of the government are saying that the government failed to adequately message the population, especially in a country where you have close to about 100 different languages.
I agree with you that messaging is important, is very, very important, especially when there are all kinds of conspiracy theory. You even know in the United States, some people say it doesn't exist, it's a manufactured disease, and you go online, there are all kinds of weird theories. You can therefore imagine what the situation is in Nigeria. A number of people say it's a white man's disease, it's a Western disease, it doesn't happen here, the heat kills the virus. Wrong. So that's where you're correct, that the messaging is important. The government needs to go down to the local level, different languages, local level, even in broken English that everybody would like to understand. Involve the market leaders, involve the towns and the local community leaders, involve the traditional leader, involve the youths. In fact, one of the slogans should be COVID-19 or Corona is everybody's disease.
Nigerians are known for their communal living. And a lot of people are saying that's also part of the problem. So how do you navigate this?
One, let us all believe and know that this will be a short-term thing. This is not going to be our life going forward. This will be a short period. So if we say, please do not visit your relative in the next 2 weeks, in the next 1 month, let them stay in their own households.
That's Dr. Anthony Ibe, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Howard University and Georgetown School of Medicine. He spoke with me in Washington, D.C. U.S. President Donald Trump can be heard on tape pleading with Georgia's election chief to overturn President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the state. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
In an audio recording obtained by the Associated Press of a call Saturday between the president, Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, and others, the president says,
I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state, and flipping the state is a great testament to our country.
In the call, Trump repeats a litany of claims of alleged voter fraud and irregularities, to which Raffensperger responds,
well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is the data you have is wrong.
Biden senior advisor Bob Bauer calls the recording irrefutable proof of Trump pressuring and threatening an official in his own party to overturn the election. Ben Thomas, Washington.
The release of the recording of President Trump's conversation with officials in Georgia comes just a few days before members of the U.S. Congress certify the vote count. Some members of Trump's Republican Party are expressing concern about the support some Republicans are giving to the president's attempt to overturn the election. Julie Walker with the AP has more.
In the hour-long Saturday call, Trump repeatedly pushes his disproven claims of fraud to try and get his way.
I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
But Brad Raffensperger continually disagrees with Trump's claims.
President Trump, we've had several lawsuits, and we've had to respond in court to the lawsuits and the contentions. We don't agree that you have won.
Georgia counted its votes three times before certifying Biden's win by a margin of 11,779 votes. I'm Julie Walker.
Media reports say U.S. President Donald Trump recently received unconfirmed intelligence information indicating that China offered money to non-state actors in Afghanistan to attack American soldiers. Ayush Goel in Islamabad is covering the story and spoke to International Edition's Steve Miller.
Well, what we understand from the intelligence that has been shared with President Donald Trump is that Chinese have offered bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, and that was quite a revelation because it has come out at a time when tensions have heightened between China and the United States. And now with this revelation, or alleged revelation, obviously things will become more problematic for the two big powers. We know that we have been told that so far this intelligence has not been confirmed, and U.S. officials are still working to corroborate whatever intelligence they have gathered so far.
As you mentioned, the intelligence has not been confirmed, and they're still working to sort things out. But overall, what's been the reaction, not only from the U.S., but from Afghan officials?
Well, this is interesting because we tried our best to reach out to officials in Kabul to get some reaction, but they have been really dead silent. They have not said anything. They have basically said that they are waiting for U.S. officials to come out on the record and share some details. Only then they would be able to comment on this. So we have not received or seen any reaction from officials in Afghanistan.
Ayaz, this sounds very familiar to allegations that the U.S. intelligence community made against Russia, saying that they were paying bounties on U.S. troops.
It's more or less the same thing, you know, what U.S. officials have said about Russia paying bounties to militants in Afghanistan, and now Chinese doing the same thing. The difference between the two is that at that time, about the allegations against Russia, we knew for sure from U.S. officials that the militants that were allegedly being paid bounties on U.S. soldiers were part of the Taliban insurgency, the same insurgency that the United States was discussing with a peace agreement at that time. That's when this scandal emerged, that Taliban and U.S. officials were negotiating, which obviously ended on a very sort of a landmark agreement between the two adversaries. But here, in case of the Chinese bounties that were allegedly being paid to non-state actors, you know, that's what U.S. officials reportedly have referred to non-state actors. They have not clearly said whether these non-state actors are linked to the Taliban or they are part of other groups operating in Afghanistan. But we know that Chinese are worried. They have repeatedly conveyed to Afghan officials that this East Turkestan Islamic movement, which China has declared as a terrorist group and has been carrying out attacks in China's western Xinjiang region. And allegedly, according to Chinese officials, these militants have bases in Afghanistan. So we know for sure that these are the militants that China wants to root out, but which non-state actors the U.S. intelligence has found to be in contact with Chinese, we still have no idea.
That's Ayaz Goel speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller from Islamabad. A British court ruled Monday that WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange will not be extradited to the U.S. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to Henry Ridgewell in London for the latest.
The decision announced today was that Julian Assange cannot be extradited to the United States, not because the British judge disagreed with the charges that the US has put against Mr. Assange, but rather that they say that the United States prison system is unable to prevent him from taking his own life. The judge ruled that Mr. Assange presents a very significant suicide risk and that the situation that he would be in the United States, which is the conditions that national security suspects are put under during trial, would amount almost to solitary confinement, essentially, and that that would exacerbate his suicide risk, and therefore Britain could not extradite him to the United States.
And how has Assange's defense team reacted to this?
They've welcomed the ruling and welcomed the initial decision that he won't be extradited. Julian Assange's fiancée particularly was speaking outside court, and she called on the US President Donald Trump to end the prosecution altogether and essentially to pardon Julian Assange, appealing for Britain and America to allow Julian Assange freedom, to let our little boys have their father, as she put it. He's had two children even while he's been staying at the Ecuadorian embassy and latterly in a British prison as well. Press freedom groups have welcomed the ruling as well and saying it's vital for journalists that Julian Assange is not extradited and prosecuted for what he has done, although some of them wanted the extradition ruled out on the basis of protecting freedom of speech and journalism rather than on the basis of Julian Assange's mental health.
And what about the US? What's their response?
The United States has already lodged an appeal against this process. It did have 14 days, but it's taken no time in lodging that appeal, and we will await. It's not clear yet how long that appeal will take or on what basis the US will lodge it. Presumably, they will have to try to prove to the judge that her ruling that the US prison system could not prevent his suicide is wrong. So they would have to present some evidence. In the meantime, Mr. Assange has gone back to Belmarsh Prison in the United Kingdom. His lawyers say they are lodging bail papers this coming Wednesday, and they will present evidence that he does not present a flight risk, that he won't try to flee. And so that's the next big decision in this case. But how long the appeals process will go on, we don't know.
So does this mean that after, you know, years in either prison or in essentially house arrest in the Ecuadorian embassy, does this mean Assange will be going free?
It depends what the British justice system decides to do, the Crown Prosecution Service here in the United Kingdom, because some of those confidential documents that have been released by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks concern British service personnel, British intelligence agents as well. And Britain may decide that its own agents' lives were put at risk and that its national security was put at risk, and that Julian Assange breached the Official Secrets Act here in the United Kingdom, which is actually stricter than the measures you have there in the United States. And therefore, they might decide to prosecute him here, sort of with the cooperation and help of the United States as well. If that goes ahead, we would expect Julian Assange to remain in custody while he was prosecuted under the British legal system. If Britain decides not to prosecute him, and if the US appeal against the refusal to extradite him fails, then he will have to go free.
That's my colleague, Jason Patinkin, speaking with VOA's Henry Ridgewell from London. This is the Voice of America. Iranian forces have seized a South Korean-flagged tanker. Iranian media on Monday said the country's elite Revolutionary Guards Navy seized the vessel for polluting the Gulf with chemicals. United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operations Naval Authority earlier said on its website that an, quote, interaction, unquote, between Iranian authorities and a merchant vessel in the Strait of Hormuz led the ship to alter its course and proceed into Iranian waters. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Monday that Iran's resumption of 20% uranium enrichment was aimed at developing nuclear weapons and that Israel would never allow Tehran to build them. In a statement, Netanyahu said Iran's enrichment decision could be explained only as a bid to continue to carry out its intention to develop a military nuclear program. He added, quote, Israel would not allow Iran to produce nuclear weapons, end quote. When the new year rang in, so did a new era in Europe, one without Britain as part of the European Union. The process for the United Kingdom to leave the EU took years to complete, and negotiations to resolve a litany of trade issues went down to the wire before both sides came to an agreement. So with the first weekend completed, how are things going between the UK and the 27-member EU bloc? International Edition's Steve Miller gets the update from Catherine Field in Paris.
It was smooth, but part of that was because of two very important factors. One was COVID. The French have very much put in place strict rules that any trucks that are coming over to France from the United Kingdom, the drivers have to have a negative COVID test. So that slowed things down a bit. Also, it was the weekend, so there weren't that many trucks on the road as there would be. Plus, because there was this big concern that there would be just chaos at the border, a lot of companies got their stock in advance, which is why we saw such heavy traffic across the channel between the UK and France in the last month or so. So, you know, it's in some ways, it's given everyone on the ground a chance to get these new systems in place, see how it's working. And for the time being, it seems to be working, but these are early days, so they were quite pleased. It was a quiet start, a quiet weekend.
Speaking of cross-border and trade and travel, what about the Irish border? Because that was a focus of a lot of discussions because that becomes a hard border between Britain and the European Union.
Oh, indeed. We've already seen over the weekend several trucks were turned back from UK ports. They were hoping to get these trucks with the goods on the ferries over to the Republic of Ireland. They were turned back because they didn't have the right documentation. Even though the United Kingdom has given a bit of leeway to companies with when it comes to some of the paperwork, they've said they'll be a little bit lenient over the next 12 months. The European Union isn't that lenient, and they say they want all the supporting paperwork in place. So, you know, they're saying you wanted zero tariff access to the EU. That was on condition that you had the paperwork. So that was why we saw that traffic between the west coast of the United Kingdom and Ireland, some trucks being turned back.
So what's next? Because the British Parliament has already passed the Brexit agreement, but the European Union Parliament has not. So what do we need to keep an eye out for?
The next date to look for will be probably sometime in February when the European Parliament votes on it. Then it actually does get over that last hurdle. There's no guarantee that they will agree it, that they won't have all the numbers. But certainly, you know, there's been a lot of backwards and forwards, a lot of the normal backward and forwards you get from the Commission, the Executive Branch and the European Parliament has been there. So we're looking at that date. After that, it does actually become law. And then, and I hate to break this to you, then we start again to start negotiating an agreement between the EU and the United Kingdom for financial services. So we're going to go all the way back to the start again.
That's International Edition's Steve Miller speaking with journalist Catherine Miller from Paris. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, our colleague Jason Patinkin, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.